This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Remember the story of Johnny Appleseed, the man who legend says roamed the country planting his seeds wherever he went? Well, Janice Ray isn't roaming the country planting seeds. She's touring colleges and universities around the country, talking about the importance of saving different varieties of seeds before they're lost forever.
As an environmentalist, I saw that the most active young people were the ones who were tackling food.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from Janice about the seed underground. Then we'll visit a museum exhibit that features one of the most important documents of the 19th century. And we'll spend an academic minute trying to find out if resistance really is futile. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Think about the amount of information contained in a seed. The entire genetic makeup and building block of the plant is all right there in a tiny little nub. However, according to Janice Ray, whole volumes of that information is being lost. She says the explosion of industrial farms and genetically modified seeds is homogenizing what was once a universe of diversity in the plant world. Janice Ray is an author, naturalist, and activist. She's on the faculty of Chatham University's Low Residency MFA program, and in 2007 was awarded an honorary doctorate from Unity College in Maine. Her latest book is called The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food. We spoke recently, and I asked her how a poet and a teacher got involved with seeds.
Oh, gosh. What a hard question, Bob. I have been interested in growing things for a long, long time. And, you know, now I know the answer. The answer is life. All of those things have to do with the essence of life itself. I first got interested in seeds when I was a child. I gardened from the time I was 11 or 12 or so. And my grandmother gave me some very strange bean seeds. They're about an inch long. Very beautiful white beans with dark eyes. She called them jack beans. And I planted them. They grew very big. The pods are a foot long and these fat seeds throughout. And it sort of fired me up. I got fired up very young for plants and growing things. I think that we have written in our DNA an ancient history with plants. Humans for at least 12,000 years and as much as 70,000, some scientists argue, have been domesticating, diversifying, adapting plants. So I think it's a pretty common feeling, this connection to the plant world.
In your book, you actually mourn the loss of so many varieties of different seeds. Just how much have we lost?
In 1901 and 1902, kind of a comprehensive catalog of seed varieties available at that time was published. In 2004, two scientists at the University of Georgia decided to look at those varieties available a century ago compared to the ones available now. 94% of the varieties available in 1901 were not available in 2004, a 94% decline. Now, these are place-adapted, vintage, heirloom, locally adapted seeds. The statistics are even more startling when you think, let's break it down. So cabbages, 95% of vintage cabbages are gone, 96% of field corns. It means what happened is an industrialization of agriculture so that people like my grandfather who farmed a small diversified farm here in southern Georgia and grew all kinds of food crops for his family to sell extra. He began to use chemical fertilizer. He began, when hybrid corn came out, to use hybrid corn seed and then to use tractors. He sold his mules. We saw the rise and fall of old-time diversified organic agriculture, and then the rise again in the last 50 or 60 years, and even sooner, a renaissance of agriculture that speaks to health, to nutrition, to health of the soil, to environmental health.
those seeds are no longer being offered in catalogs. Now, are they gone for good, or are they just not being sold anymore? Say the more productive ones are being sold.
Seeds have inherently a viability. And so you can save, you can deep freeze seeds and save them for 10, 15 years, if you're lucky, 50, in some cases longer. But they're gone. The short answer, Bob, is they're gone. They're gone for good. Now, when the Seed Savers Exchange began in 1975, a lot of seed folklorists, we'll call them, stalked the country looking for heirloom varieties. And so many varieties thought lost have been reintroduced into the marketplace. But in general, it is a true decline. We go into a grocery store now and we can buy Granny Smith apple and Red Delicious apple. But 100 years ago, there were 7,000 varieties of apples in this country. Many, many, many. And 86% of them just gone. Now, here and there, you'll find orchards that are heirloom orchards that are keeping these varieties alive. But in general, the industrialization of ag has led us to monocultures, to standardization, and that means more and more farmers planting decreasing numbers, decreasing diversity of seeds.
Tell us about the Seed Saver Exchange and who they are and what they do.
The Seed Savers Exchange is an organization headquartered in Decorah, Iowa. They have hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands of members. It began in 1975. A couple, they were married at the time, named Diane and Kent Whaley, started this organization. They were taking care of Diane's grandfather, Baptist John Ott. He had immigrated to this country from Eastern Europe and had brought with him a few garden plants. One was a morning glory. They realized that when he died, and he did die, that they were the only people left to steward these seeds. These seeds would die out. So they named the Morning Glory Grandpa Ott's Morning Glory. There was a German pink tomato as well. And it was that incident that engendered in them the realization that all over this country, people are dying and we're losing seeds. First, few of us are farming. In 1904, 41% of Americans farmed. Now it's less than 2%. Of we who farm, the number of acres we farm is smaller and smaller. These acres, more of these acres are planted in annuals and less in perennials. And the diversity of what we plant is constricting. So what Seed Savers Exchange did, really, was awakened in me and awakened in many, many people across the country, this realization, the knowledge that we needed to do something. I think, too, Bob, we should speak about famine. Anytime that we shrink diversity, in this case, agro-diversity, we become more at risk of some kind of collapse. The lumper potato was the variety of potato mostly being grown in Ireland in the mid-1800s. It developed a late blight, which affected it not so much in the garden, not so much the leaf, but in the root in storage. So basically, people's potatoes were rotten in storage. Now, this was an entirely prolific potato. A family could plant an acre and have enough to last the year. When the potatoes began to rot, that initiated what we all know of as the potato famine, the Irish, and it initiated a diaspora of an entire people. So we know what is possible if we shrink our genetic base too much. I will say, as an addendum, that in many ways, a famine is already occurring in this country. you know as well as I do, we can walk through the grocery stores and we see packages and boxes and bags and an incredible diversity of products, like in the cereal aisle. But if we read the ingredients, a few crops are providing the building blocks for all of food, probably three or four crops, you know, corn, wheat, soybeans, rice. In many ways, a wheat blight, for example, has already descended. More and more people have gluten intolerance, celiac disease. Celiacs, I believe that a lot of food allergens can be tied to our vegetable breeding, that we are breeding for production, not for nutrition, and we are, in many cases, altering the proteins found in wheat, for example. So some serious consequences of our shrinking genetic base.
Well, look ahead if you can. What do you see? Do you see it getting better, worse, or worse before it gets better?
What I see is tremendous hope, and that's one of the reasons that I wrote this book. I'm lucky enough to be able to travel to universities and speak with young people. In these deeply transformative conversations with young people, I would feel such a hopelessness. You know, they saw what we see, that we're in a period of incredible climate variability, that they're being handed this cocktail of problems, you know, toxification of the earth, climate change, the first decrease in longevity, on and on. And then what I saw were that the ones who had turned to food, who had decided that they wanted to make a difference, they wanted to actually be involved in the production of food, and they wanted to return themselves to lives that made sense. They wanted to put nutritious food in their bodies. They began lobbying their cafeterias to buy locally, to buy organically. They began starting little gardens on campus, on and on and on. As an environmentalist, I saw that the most active young people were the ones who were tackling food. And that was indicative of our culture. People are flooding to farmers markets, to food, natural food cooperatives, starting buying clubs, starting community gardens, gardening in their backyard. Gene Logsdon calls the backyard the most popular vacation land of the future. And that gave me tremendous hope. I return again to Sylvia DeVos. You know, I may not be able to make much of a difference in the big world. Who knows? But I feel that in my own garden, I'm this radical peasant here doing something every day. I have my little hammer out, and I'm building something in this garden. And honestly, Bob, I can't think of anything more hopeful than that.
Again, the name of Janice Ray's new book is The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food. You can learn more at JaniceRay.com. Still to come, an important piece of American history is being put on display. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1157. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The only surviving preliminary draft of President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation is being exhibited at museums across New York State. The Best of Our Knowledge's Pat Bradley was at the SUNY Plattsburgh Art Museum when the historic document was on display for one day.
Crowds of people were entering the Myers Fine Arts Building's Burke Gallery to view the rare handwritten document long held in the vaults of the New York State Library. This is part of a special tour to commemorate the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. New York State Regent James Dawson.
This is extremely unique because the documents that you see here don't travel. They just don't travel. If it weren't that this was the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, this document would be housed deep in a safe in the New York State Library. And it's not even on public display in the New York State Library.
There are preservation issues.
New York State Education Department Deputy Commissioner for Cultural Education, Jeffrey Cannell.
The document, it's in Lincoln's own hand. Having it exposed to any light degrades it over time. So we're very careful. We've owned it for 150 years, taken care of it for 150 years. And if we continue to do it successfully, it'll be around for the 200th anniversary.
Regent James Dawson explains how the New York State Museum and Library came to own this document.
The United States Sanitary Commission was a private entity established by the Congress that took care of wounded soldiers and existed for about a year after the war and provided housing for wounded veterans. And he ended up giving them this document to raffle off, basically. And they raffled it off. And Garrett Smith, who was very busy buying land up here in Clinton, Essex, and Franklin counties, so that he could settle very poor African Americans from some of the big cities, bought 1,000 of the tickets and won the lottery, and then sold the document to the legislature, we think so that he could make a bit of a profit and use the money to buy more land to do the good abolition work that he was doing. The legislature then gave it to the New York State Library for stewardship. It's been there ever since.
Plattsburgh State Art Museum Director Seal Esposito.
It's beautiful. It is an absolutely gorgeous document. The handwriting is amazing. The paper, the patina on the paper and the age and the signatures, it's just all just very moving. I think it's interesting the prose, the way in which it's written, the actual words. And we do have a brochure that actually has the entire transcript in it. And just the manner in which it's written, the legal ease as well as just the style of the day is very impressive.
The exhibition is called The First Step to Freedom. SUNY Plattsburgh President John Etling, an historian, notes this pivotal document contains some differences from the final proclamation.
In the preliminary document, which was engrossed and signed by both Lincoln and his Secretary of State, William Seward, who was a former governor of New York, it gave the rebellious states of the Confederacy 100 days to lay down their arms and keep their slaves. But he said, if you don't stop this rebellion, then we will issue an Emancipation Proclamation formally freeing your slaves. And so it gave Southern states a chance to reconsider the course of action that they had been on for a year and a half. And of course, 100 days later, they weren't ready to give up. And so he issued the formal Emancipation Proclamation freeing the slaves on January 1st, 1863. And it's also letting the South know that now the abolition of slavery was a formal, acknowledged, official wartime goal for the United States.
The museum has coordinated with local schools, and three classes of fifth graders were among the first to arrive. Standing in line ahead of them was Scott Coleman of Morrisonville and his son, Connor.
I'm very excited. I come from Louisiana, actually. I moved up here 18 years ago, so I, you know, have some of a history of seeing what prejudice is like in the South. And my kids were very excited, too. Carson's in fifth grade, and he knows what the Emancipation Proclamation is, of course. They're very excited, too, to see the document.
Carson, your dad says you're excited?
Yeah, really excited. I don't know how to say it. He saw it in the newspaper.
How much do you know about President Lincoln and the proclamation?
We were learning about it in social studies, so I know a bit about him. Very important since it freed the slaves.
You feel like you're close to him. You know, my son said, "You think his ghost is walking around here, Daddy?" But just to know that you're at least close to something that it was very near and dear to him and that he wrote with his own hand is very exciting, because history seems so far away sometimes, so to actually see a piece of written history and get so close to it is definitely exciting.
President Lincoln's preliminary Emancipation Proclamation will be displayed at Rochester, followed by Binghamton, Utica, and Albany. It has already been shown in Syracuse and on Long Island. Reporting for The Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Pat Bradley.
It was a buffalo soldier in the heart of America, stolen from Africa, brought to America, fighting an arrival, fighting for survival.
Human history is filled with resistance movements, both violent and nonviolent. How successful have they been? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Citizens in a number of countries around the globe are engaged in active struggles against oppressive regimes. Erica Chenoweth, assistant professor of international studies at the University of Denver, explains why some resistance movements are more successful than others.
Maria Stefan and I began this project with the goal of understanding whether strategic nonviolent resistance or armed action is superior at achieving political change. We collected data on all known uprisings between 1900 and 2006, with more than 1,000 visible participants seeking the overthrow of a dictatorship, secession, or the removal of a foreign military occupation. We identified 108 cases where unarmed civilians used a variety of nonviolent methods, such as strikes, boycotts, protests, demonstrations, stayaways, and go-slows, and 225 cases where rebels used violent methods, such as bombings, assassinations, armed attacks, and direct confrontations with government forces. The results of our research astonished both of us. Amazingly, the nonviolent campaigns were more than twice as successful as the violent ones, even in the face of brutal regime repression. And countries that experienced nonviolent uprisings were much more likely to emerge from the conflicts democratic and with a lower risk of civil war relapse. Nonviolent campaigns tend to fail when they don't attract a large number of diverse participants, when they succumb to internal factional fighting, or when they fail to shift between methods of concentration, like demonstrations, rallies, and protests, and lower risk methods of dispersion, like strikes and boycotts. Our book challenges the claim that violent resistance is fruitful as an avenue of political change. In many cases where violent insurgency has worked, a well-executed nonviolent campaign may have been equally as successful. And in most places where nonviolent resistance is impossible, violent resistance does not perform any better. If enough people become convinced that civil resistance works while creating more stable and representative democracies, then over time it may become a sufficient substitute for violence.
That was Erica Chenoweth of the University of Denver. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.